Over two centuries ago, it was England that taxed our tea. Now it's Brussels trying to regulate our companies. Under new European regulations, American businesses face crushing fines, forced disclosures, and foreign red tape that kills jobs here at home. America's laws should be written in America, not Brussels. Reject European regulatory overreach and uphold Trump's trade deal. Paid for by Americans for Limited Government.
Boogie Beatdown coming at you. Paul, Cody, UFC Vegas 112 from the Apex in Las Vegas, Nevada. Last card, last UFC card of the calendar year. We were talking about before. There's a bit of like weird like add-ons late. Like there's one fight that I haven't seen odds for yet. It's probably one of those things where it's like they contractually have to owe you a few fights and they're like, oh, this guy's in town and wants to fight. We've got, you know, someone else in town to corner him. So Isaac Thompson versus Joe Anderson Brito, that's happening. There's also Bobby Green versus Lance Gibson Jr. That just kind of came out of left.
Weird.
That just kind of came out of left field. That's happening. Yeah.
There's been rumors circulating that Fight Pass is apparently close to its demise. Yeah, and so now the UFC is just scooping up all the guys that might be able to help sell tickets on these regional promotions and just taking them in the full. So yeah, you're not wrong. Yaroslav Amosov's on the card, Isaac Thompson, LFA champs on there, the CFFC champs on there, one of Bellator's top prospects for a long time is on there. And then guys that are not even considered prospects in the slightest bit, like Alan Fry and Guillermo Pat, but they're heavyweights. Let's go ahead and scoop them up too. So last week you got one of the most stacked lineups of the year. And this year you've got a full episode of Dana White's Contender Series in long form programming. So, 13 fights, but, the majority of it is a little bit rough. I'm down. It's a super stacked regional show, but it's a little bit weird how some of these guys ended up on the card for sure.
Yeah. Someone in the Discord brought up like that post by I forget who it was, but who said that it sounds like, you know, that UFC Fight Pass is shutting down. And then like 2 days later, I look at my credit card bill and it's just like, oh, $53 and whatever cents from the UFC. I'm like, what is that? And I look and it's like, charge me for 6 months. 6 months of UFC Fight Pass. So they may not even have cards, Dana.
So
Dana, good. you're making like you brag about all this money you're making on blackjack all the time. Give me my $50 back. If you guys aren't gonna have regional shows, then I don't know what I'd be paying you for. I mean, I'd still need it for like tape study and all of that. But it sounds like they're gonna move all that stuff off of it as well.
Yeah,
well, I don't know. Interesting times.
It's like they own the video libraries. Why not at least just have somewhere you could go watch old fights? But in the same breath, it's like, well, they figured out that you could just sell Cage Warriors library back to some European company that's gonna chop up the media. And same thing with LFA and same thing with CFFC. I hadn't really noticed until somebody was like, well, why don't you think LFA's got any fights booked coming up? And that's when it hit me like just a ton of bricks. Paul, we've officially been breaking down LFA cards for the last 12 months. They happen every week. They happen every other week. It's next to the UFC, the most consistently run show. And yet, they're taking this little break to kind of figure out what's going on. So go ahead.
Sorry. If LFA is not being listed as Fight Pass, then I would be like, you know, then WOW FC probably doesn't stand a chance, right?
Well, yeah, CFFC and WOW and FCR, I believe, is one from Sweden.
Fight Club Rush, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, hey, we like watching it, but I think for the UFC, no, they don't all have the same deal. I think Unified MMA gets $5,000 a show, $6,000 a show, but Fight Pass was getting in the neighborhood of $80,000 per show. So if you're doing 20 shows, it's $1.6 million. If you're doing 40 shows, it's $3 million. Like, for LFA as a product. So at some point, I think they just realized, hey, LFA is currently negotiating with ESPN. So they're going to hopefully just try to work out their own separate television deal where they can just play their stuff on ESPN. But if you're a fight fan, you realize, you know, in Canada, Sportsnet doesn't even carry all these UFCs because it doesn't rate huge with the audience. If they got baseball on, or they got basketball on, or they got hockey on, that does better numbers. So LFA will be the same thing. How many people are realistically going to watch LFA on a Friday night on ESPN? Probably less than would watch canned programming of poker being rerun. So I don't know. It's probably not going to be a great year in 2026 for regional promotions. But sports going through changes again.
Yeah, but then you have other organizations. Like you have the KSWs, the Octagons. That like they've never been aligned with you know, UFC Fight Pass, or at least for the North American audience, they haven't. And it's like, you always get lines for them. So it'll be interesting to see. I think some of the smaller regionals, the FCRs, the Unifieds, the BFLs, they may not get lines, you know? Like, if there's not a if there's not a common place like Fight Pass to for people to actually watch what they bet, I don't know if the books are going to be offering it, but time will tell. I suppose it's a bit of a dark time, even though there's like a big, you know, UFC just made a whole bunch of money switching over to Paramount Plus or whatever. So just keep the status quo. We like all of these regional promotions. Anyway, people are here not to hear us gripe about regionals being, you know, limited, I suppose. They want us to watch this glorified regional card. But it has a hell of a flyweight main event. We got Manel Kopp taking on Brandon Royval. Kopp, minus 300 favorite. The comeback on Royval, plus 250. Who you got, Code?
Well, it's a flyweight fight, Paul. So just like Pantoja versus Joshua Van Last, we're going to just spam some underdog plus money. I'm kidding. That was a total freak incident that, I don't know, who knows what the fight would have played out to be. We don't know. But you don't expect a guy just to break his arm like that early in the fight and never give you the idea. For this fight, though, I am going to chase that plus money on Brandon Royval. It's a five-round fight. And again, as far as I'm concerned, Brandon Royval is built for these 25-minute long fights. The guy's got infinite amounts of cardio, trains at altitude, and really can do everything. He started off as just a tenacious grappler, a guy that's very opportunistic, chases the scrambles, chases the submissions, wrestling really not all that great. But because he's gotten to a point where his wrestling's not good enough to 100% take down the best guys, and if you can't take them down, then this world-class jiu-jitsu is out the window, that he's really been forced to work on his striking. And I think he's made a whole lot of improvements there. He's big with the volume. He's big with the pressure. He's big with just throwing out extended combinations, causing you to make a mistake. And then if he can get the fight to the ground, that's where he's going to be at his best. If he's not, he's just going to try to drown you. Manel Kopp, meanwhile, he's got just huge power. Very athletic, hits very hard, moves very well. I'm not saying he doesn't have the same volume to keep up. You have seen in that fight with Bruno Silva, again, when he's having his own way and it's just target practice, he can throw some higher volume. But for the most part, I feel like he is there to be outworked. We've seen in his early portion of his UFC career, I guess that's a while ago, but sometimes he feels that he's up in rounds that are close. Sometimes he takes his foot off the gas and allows his opponent to work his way back into it. And this being a five-round fight, I feel like Royval's got a good enough chin to take some of those early shots, extend this thing out, get him to deeper waters, constantly make him work, and just keep this thing very, very close on the scorecards. If you can keep it close on the scorecards, yeah, then this plus money shot would be worth it in my eyes. So listen, I know I'm getting myself into a tough one here, and that Manel Kopp is a world-class operator. He's got enough power that even against a guy with a cast iron chin, he can still put out anybody's lights. And when you're looking for those eye-catching blows, it should be him. But for my money's worth, I just do feel like Royval is capable of keeping everything he's in close. Look at a lot of these numbers. Him versus Josh Van. He actually outstruck Josh Van 215 to 204. That's in a 15-minute long fight. Give him two more rounds, he's scoring upwards of 300 significant strikes landed. So even if Manel Kopp comes out and lands 140 or 150, you can still double up a guy, which is crazy to think. His own fight with Tatsuya Taira. Taira, again, you know, a top guy in the division, but he triples him up in the significant strikes. He gets taken down. He scrambles. He gets back up. He mixes in takedowns of his own. It's a complete game, and I really do feel like the judges are looking at damage. They're looking at who's coming forward, and they're looking at who's winning these specific spots, who's using the grappling, who's using the striking, who's coming forward, who's landing those big shots. Maybe Kopp's landing the more eye-catching blows, but there should be more of them coming through from Royval. You can make a good case on either guy. You really can. But for the plus money... Yeah, it really comes down to, I got to take me some Brandon Royval here. So raw dog, just out hustle him and hopefully get it done on the scorecards.
Yeah, I was expecting you to kind of like talk me into Manel Kopp here, but my sentiments have been the exact same. It's like, it seems very, very dog or pass. Like, Kopp could definitely come out here, get a knockout. I know Royval, very, very durable, everything like that. But Kopp, when he goes into like, the zone, you know, very, very dangerous guy. And frankly, like when he's forced to put up a lot of volume, he 100% can, like 111 in just over 12 minutes of work against Bruno Silva. I mean, we're talking way, way lower level of competition, but the fight that really kind of illuminates why I think Roy Val plus 250 seems like such a good opportunity is that Felipe Dos Santos fight. And that was only 2 years ago, a little bit over 2 years ago. But, like, that was damn close on the feet. You make this an absolute dogfight. You make this tit-for-tat striking affair. Cobb's probably landing the more powerful strikes, but I don't know if he can keep up with 200 significant strikes over the course of 25 minutes. So, it's Brandon Royval plus 250 for me as well. We move on down to the co-main event. We've got Kevin Vallejos taking on Giga Chikadze. Vallejos, a minus 300 favorite. The comeback on Giga plus 250. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, so with Giga, and I know this is just Narrative Nation, and I've had a few of these wrong where it's like, oh, Peter Yan's not sparring as much lately. Everyone believes it's because he's starting to get a little bit hurt. And then it turns out, but Peter Yan doesn't spar as much because he's spending a lot more time in wrestling practice. And I'm totally wrong. The narrative here on Giga Chikadze is that he just doesn't seem like he's fully interested anymore. It's not like he's overly an aged fighter, but he's starting to get up there, and I believe 35, 36 years old. Sorry, even only 30... seven possibly. Let me just confirm that for you.
He 37. Is, yeah,
37 years old. Missed weight in his last fight with David Onama, right? So at 6 feet tall, he's a big guy for this weight class. Making 145 pounds hasn't been easy. People that are in camp with him have mentioned that he's been very injured over the last few years. He's been on record talking about that his body's not necessarily keeping as much, can't get through these training camps, not competing as regularly as he'd like to. And then you jump back in there and you're forced to take on one of these young, hungry, up-and-comer guys like Kevin Vallejos. Now, he's a lot bigger. He's got a lot, I think, a 4-inch reach advantage over him. He is the more refined technical striker, but it really does come down to volume. If you're not knocking this guy out, then you're presumably going to have to fight him for a hard 15. And in a hard 15, Giga Chikadze, say, from 3 years ago, him versus Calvin Kattar, you know, there's a fight that he puts up some volume, but he gets at work. It's since then. Since then, he's been a lot more reserved. I mean, he's using these front kicks out the middle. He's trying to fight long, but these younger, hungrier guys that are able to enter that pocket and kind of touch him up a little bit, constantly just kind of start beating him to the punch, outworking him, getting these numbers up on the scorecards, and then beating him. Arnold Allen, no shame in losing to Arnold Allen, world-class operator, top 10 guy of the division. But again, he looks hesitant in that entire fight to really let his hands go. Last fight against David Onama, Onama mixes in some wrestling as well. But Onama's not really a great wrestler by any stretch, and it's more so that Giga's waiting too long for his spots. If he's looking to counter, that's one thing. But unless you're knocking the guy out, waiting to counter is just you waiting too long. And so I think when you look back at some of his earlier fights, him versus Edson Barboza, him versus Cub Swanson, him versus, as we mentioned, the Calvin Kattar fight, in those fights, he seemed to have a little more oomph to him, a little more desire, a little more ability to keep up with his opponents. But over the last few, I don't know if it's injuries, I don't know if it's age, I don't know if it's disinterest, but he seemingly is just going through the motions. Because he's such a world-class striker, he's not necessarily getting hurt, he's not necessarily getting put away, but he's not necessarily doing enough to win the fight outright and therefore is dropping these decisions. Kevin Vallejos, meanwhile, he represents just that young, hungry challenger, 24 years old, Argentinian kid, can take one hell of a punch. But that's kind of his game, is that he will make this as aggressive as possible, stand in the pocket and try to outbox you. Him versus Gene Silva on the Contender Series. I mean, he gave Silva one hell of a fight. Unfortunately, comes up on the short end of it. Nobody's fought Silva and said, yeah, I want another run at him. But Vallejos has. And he's been drumming that up for a while. He wants to fight the better guys. He's young. He's looking to get paid. And he's got this type of style that, you know, is going to get a $50,000 bonus because he's collecting performance of the nights. Cam Teague, that's an easy win for him. Sung Hoo Choi goes down before the fight really gets started. That last fight with Danny Silva, what I liked about it is that he mixed in some of his wrestling in that spot as well. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to see him do that against Giga Chikadze. Chikadze, I wouldn't say he's one-dimensional with the striking, but being that he's tall, being that you're going to have to enter that pocket, land a couple good shots, mix it up, take him down, score some points, neutralize him, cause him to carry your weight, cause him to get back up. And then when he gets back up, because there's the threat of the takedown now established on the table, he won't open up with his offense. He's not going to look to throw a 3 or 4 punch combination, throwing off with a kick, because he's worried to get taken down. If he's shelling up and he's freezing up a little bit, Vallejos even more so is probably going to just outwork him on the stats. So I got Kevin Vallejos to get the job done here. I will say, looking at this fight, you got a 5'7" fighter taking on a 6-foot fighter. And I'm hoping that
300 doesn't feel very appetizing.
It doesn't feel good at all, right? In the main event, it's actually the polar opposite. Brandon Royval's 5'9", right? Manel Kopp's only 5'5". And when you look at Kopp, his last fight against Almabayev, Almabayev's 5'4". Bruno Silva's 5'4". Felipe Dos Santos, you're right. Dos Santos gave him a good go. Dos Santos stands really upright. He's only 5'7". You know, in that fight, I think height's going to make a big difference. In this co-main event, I'm hoping it's the opposite. I'm hoping the shorter guy gets into the pocket. Giga Chikot's not going to really use his footwork all that much. He's not going to move away. He's just going to try to hit him entering in, get hit a few times, mix in the takedown, outwork this guy. Capable of doing it. Let's do it here. So, Vallejos, I don't like this minus 300, so personally, I'm chasing him by decision.
Yeah, I mean, the trick to beating Giga Chikadze, I think, is to be, one, all the way in and pressure, which Kevin Vallejos really doesn't have any problems with. He's not hanging out in kicking range. He's usually shorter than most of his opponents, to be perfectly honest. Get in there, in tight, boxing range, body shots, and takedowns. The one thing I will add to it is that some books offer like takedown props and stuff like that a little bit closer to fight night. A Vallejos over takedown prop could actually be kind of like juicy, because like he's not listed as being a wrestler, but if David Onama's taking you down three times and Giga Chikots last time out, wouldn't be surprised if Vallejos gets to one or two at the very least. It's tough to get Giga out of there. Probably goes to decision. Vallejos by decision. Plus 150 is the best on market. It's probably how I will approach that fight this week. But, you know, it's still Wednesday. A lot of thought to go into it. I may wait it out, to be perfectly honest, too, because you know how people are. With stare downs and stuff like that, you may get a better price on Vallejos come fight day because people see, oh, tall guy, and then they bet.
Yeah, they it's bet so
the
hard
tall,
to
the
see.
The tall underdog gets bet all the time.
It happens all the time in weigh-ins, you're right.
I mean, we're doing it with Roy Vell, so.
You see the size, and then you start to think, oh, you start to rub your hands together. And then in the same breath, the Giga Chikots comes in at 147 again. Mm. Then they're going to say, oh, he's got another bad weight cut, and he's not going to fight well. And
then you get a worse price.
Yeah, but it's hard to say what's a good price and what's a bad price on the basis of, like, you look at Isaac Dalgarian, and it has a crazy line shiftment. And everyone says, oh, see, told you so. And then last weekend, not to a lesser extent, but it's happening to Duncan. And it's like, do you just automatically bail? The difference is that Duncan's still fighting a guy that's only got 2 minutes in him.
Yeah.
So what is it? Who cares what the
that
line
didn't movement? Surprise me. Like people in the Discord were going on about that one, and I was just like, if you're going to bet Terrence McKinney, you bet him pre-flop. There is no bet him live because the fight may be damn well. If he wins, the fight's probably damn well over before they reopen the live market ever again. That being said, that fight was so crazy that there was no live betting to be had. Like once they started, it was just like the books were basically just like locked. And I don't know if it even ever opened again. I was trying to get in, but
if you can get plus money on anything. Terrence McKinney, it always seems like a good idea because his path of victory. Yeah, exactly. It is that he will go for it 100% and he is capable of catching it. So when the line was minus 200, Chris Duncan, it makes all the sense in the world that money's going to be coming in on the other side. All of a sudden it's down to even money. It's this thing's got to be a fix. No, see, it won't go to McKinney favorite. It stops as soon as McKinney's no longer plus money.
Yeah.
Because that's what you're getting yourselves into. But sometimes people have created these like algorithms where it just studies the line movement and this guy moved this many points and so he becomes the pick. And like, I don't really think it means anything. You could have one rich guy drop a bunch of money and it moves the line. He moves the line a little bit. People see, oh, the line's moving. They all want to get behind it. So now they're putting their money on. Now it continues to move the line. Once this thing gets snowballing, it happens in the Dalgarian line. It moves that fast that everybody is now hedging out of their tickets. So they're betting money on him. And then it moves more. And then people are saying, holy shit, it's a fix. Therefore, it's free money. So they're jumping on board and they're moving it. And a line can move. And that one ended up being fixed. We all know the outcome on that. I'm just saying you can't necessarily.
Allegedly. No, we only have to say it so nobody got. So nobody sues us. But he got cut. And I don't believe he's said anything since. You know, his legal counsel probably is telling him not to say anything, which would lead me to believe something happened.
Yeah, they said his last spotting, he was fishing all by himself, possibly wearing boots that were made out of concrete. I am not really sure. But yeah, no, his gym kicked him out. The UFC kicked him out. His management team kicked him out. But Steve will do it. It's apparently taking care of him.
Yeah, apparently. Well, he was always taking care of him.
Yeah.
They're just really good friends, right? Yeah. I'm sure that's all it is.
Allegedly.
We know nothing. Nothing can be held against us. Cesare Oleksychuk takes on Cesar Almeida. Oleksychuk is a minus 200 favorite. Comeback on Almeida plus 170-ish. This one's moved a bit. I was looking at him a couple days ago with too much of a coward. And it was like minus 150-ish range. And I was just like, I want to bet Cesare. But then I cowered it out. Now it's at minus 200. And I didn't pull the trigger. One, I think fighting at the Fighting Nerds probably is going to have him with a good game plan here. He's tough. He's durable. And maybe he can mix in some wrestling. I mean, Roman Kopylov is not really a wrestler. And he was able to put the singlet on for one Cesar Almeida matchup. It wasn't pretty, and he gassed out as the fight kind of went late. But everybody who fights Cesar Almeida, I mean, why would you go toe-to-toe with a guy who is a kickboxer that was able to hang in there with Alex Pereira? You don't. You don't try to play that game. Can Cesare mix in the wrestling a little bit here and smoothly win this fight? At minus 200, I'm pretty hesitant to hop on board at this point. Interested to hear where you're at with this fight.
Yeah, well, because he's had so many amateur fights. Like, he's listed as 23-7, but he had a bunch of, like, youth bouts that didn't even get applied to his record. So when you look at him in the amateur ranks, he's got, like, 10 submission victories, and that was kind of a part of his game plan.
Mm-hmm.
As a pro, he only has 3 submission victories, prefers to just knock his opponent out. But I would say that this is a kid that's been competing since he's, like, 13 years old. His older brother, Lord Mikhail Oleksychuk, also in the UFC. And then their biggest thing is that they just try to get you out of there in the first round. They're first-round finishers. But seeing his brother move to Fighting Nerds, kind of develop a little more of a patience game, develop a little more of a grappling game, and really just have a game plan, like you're saying, does give you hope that Cesare could do the same thing. When you watch his last couple fights, that's exactly been it. He's got big power. He's got that ability to finish you in the first round. You're not really seeing him get stretched into the later rounds, but he's got a lot of experience. He's been competing for a long time, and one does figure that he should be able to fight in some of those later rounds. When you look at Cesar Almeida, he's got the win over Alex Pereira back in the day, and he was a kickboxing champion. But outside of that, I haven't necessarily seen it really from him. Dylan Budka took him down 3 times. Roman Kopylov took him down 5 times. Lucas Fernando took him down 3 times. Off of his back, he's got an ability to get back up. He's got an ability to stuff a few takedowns.
Ihor.
But again, yeah, Ihor Pateria taking him down 3 times as well. And then even that last fight with Abdul Razak Al-Hassan, his takedown defense looked a little bit better. Not that Al-Hassan was really committing to the takedowns, but Al-Hassan blitzed him with one hell of a shot, put him down. He was definitely had to overcome that, got back up, and eventually gets the knockout of his own. But getting a little bit older, 37 years old, reactionary time, not necessarily there. And I do feel like a guy like Cesare represents the future. It's a kid that's been competing for 10 years, and he's only 25 years old, and he's got a decade of competition experience under his belt. The younger brother of a UFC athlete, now training at a camp that's adding these secondary skills to his game. That if this is just kickboxer versus kickboxer, Almeida's a little more old time. He's got more experience. He's got a nice little wealth of experience under his belt. But outside of, you know, knocking out Abdul Razak Al-Hassan or knocking out a Dylan Butka, for the most part, he doesn't really seem to have big stinging power as much as he's just very methodical and, you know, throws nice straight punches, keeps his opponents honest, and they're giving him too much respect. Cesare could get this fight to the ground and make things a lot easier for him. Or I do think he can stand with him and just try to beat him to the punch, try to outwork him and try to really hurt this guy. Sit on these shots, find that hole. Razak Al-Hassan hits him, but Razak Al-Hassan's pushing 40 himself. This kid, Cesare, it's hard to say he's going to be a world beater, but honestly, I think that he's doing all the right things. I think we've always liked his brother. His brother tends to get himself beat more often than not just by making these slight mistakes. And since moving to the Fighting Nerds, he's really revamped his game. So we're hoping that younger bro is going to be able to do the same thing, be patient, and then just find that opening on Almeida, and that's when you're going to have to open up. Only real worry is that because he's been finishing his fights early in the first round, his last number, that if for whatever reason Almeida just, not for whatever reason, good chance he survives the first round, in the second and the third, are you able to keep that same pace? So I'm going to say, yeah, the number's starting to get away from us a little bit. But, yeah, I mean, I think he's bigger, faster, stronger, younger. Where normally it's like, well, he's also more green and he lacks that experience. I don't think he's green at all. He's got currently 19 pro fights, right?
Yep.
He's fighting a guy that has 8. So you tell me, as an amateur, he's got 30 amateur fights. And just like you said, he's already beaten guys like Tom Breeze, a UFC veteran, on the regional scene. I think that's all done it the right way. He's developed himself to the right way. What I will say is, when you look at these guys in the contender series that come over to the UFC, right? A lot of the time, like we'll talk about it earlier on this card, this Alan Fry, 6-0. And Guillerme Pat is 5-0. Melissa Croden, she's in her mid-30s, near her mid-30s. She's got less than 10 fights. Sean Sharaf, 5 fights. Steve Asplin, 7 fights. What about a guy like Isaac Thompson, 11 fights? Even Lance Gibson Jr. Lance Gibson Jr. is 30 years old. He's got 10 pro fights. You're going to see greenness out of those guys where it's like, now there's bright lights and now they're experiencing things they haven't seen before. Cesare's fought in one-day competitions where he's fought 3-4 guys. He's got 30 amateur fights and 20 pro fights. When you come to the UFC, you're a lot more of a developed product and you should be able to come out here and not go 2-2 and get cut. Not go 1-3 and hope that the UFC re-signs you. You can go out there and have a sustained run and have some success. So Almeida's not been super active. He's not a guy that competes all that often. This is his second fight of the year. I think his last one was in January or February. So, yeah, it's youth. Youth and athleticism should prevail here. So I will take Cesare, Oleksychuk.
Yeah, and that Fenn promotion out of your native Croatia. They hold events in, like, proper arenas and stuff like that. Like, the bright lights of the UFC Apex are not going to be too bright for Cesare. And there's some familiarity in the fact that his last fight, where he got first round finish with Theo Haag, was also in the Apex on the Contender Series. So you run it back in the same place. The vibe doesn't really change all that much. That
Theo Haag guy was undefeated, AKA prospect, loved to just take you down and go to the back. Never been finished before. And Cesare smacked him up twice, and you can see immediately he was just like, oh my God. Like, his legs were gone. I think he routes him. What are the striking numbers? Is 17-0, and it was 36 seconds. So obviously this is not a real stat, but Cesare's strikes landed per minute, according to UFC.com, is 28, was what they would average it at if the fight would have gone 5 minutes.
Sustainable.
Right, and his striking accuracy is 100%. Of the 17 shots he threw, every single one landed.
That's hilarious.
So, yeah, no, I actually do like this kid. I'm sure he's going to get extended out a little more than he did the last time, obviously. But I actually do like what I see out of him, and I think he's doing the right things.
Cesare by sub is plus 750.
That's not a bad price, to be honest.
I'm going
to
be taking a shot on that for sure. Why kickbox with the kickboxer? You probably can kickbox with the kickboxer, but, you know, why not try to fight a little bit of a smarter game plan? Get this fight to the mat, and if you've really been working on that ground game with the smart team that you've got and the fighting nerds, then, you know, everything that I've ever really heard about Cesare is that he's a much... Like, Michael has the reputation of being a horrible grappler. Cesare seems to be, like, dare I say, good Oleksychuk. I suppose we'll find out. Hopefully we didn't jinx him with this glowing glowing response that we
did. I matched made a card this past weekend, right? And we got main event was this kid Scout Mayer, and his little brother is Scout's 21. His little brother's 16. He's on the card as well, right? So mom and pop come out, this van, and these traveling gypsy kids jump out. There's 12 of them in the family. And they're 21, I think maybe 22 was the oldest, and like 8 was the youngest, 6 or 7, 8 was the youngest. They live on a farm. They got 12 kids. I don't know if these kids go to school. They run this little like Shetland pony operation. Point being is that these kids were like, you know, corn-fed country boys and very strong. And being that he's in a household with just a pile of siblings is they fight. And Scout, this kid's now 5-1. He's had 6 fights in the last 12 months. He'll be going pro next year. Looks like he's going to be a decent fighter. He'll be the first one to tell you. He'd be like, my little brother, North, he'd smack me up. eventually. Like, this kid is way better than me. This kid's going to be way better than me. I'm cutting the trail. I'm blazing the path, but he's got an older brother, 5 years older than him, bigger, stronger, more mature. That's passing the beatings down to him, that he's going to be able to get to that next level. Anyways, they both compete on the card this weekend. North wins second round TKO, mounts his opponent. Just really beautiful performance. Scout wins first round knockout over 5-1 opponent, catches him with the right hand, like minute into the fight. Amazing performances. See mom and dad there. See all these kids with them all celebrating. Congratulations, guys. They say, oh, well, you haven't seen the 13-year-old kid, right? He's going to be the real deal. This kid's a junkyard dog, man. This kid's a junkyard. Well, yeah. He's in a household with 12 siblings. You know, you don't get your own bed. You don't get your own meal. You don't get your own toys. You fight for everything. So I think you're constantly getting the next generation prepared by your trials and tribulations and being able to pass down that knowledge. So just like you're saying with his buddy, Lord Mikhail, this guy could always strike. When you look at his striking, he's got a lot of first round knockouts, but he's beaten some legitimately good guys. Even his OSP fight, which he lost, you know, 10-8 OSP in the first round before getting subbed in the second. What if a secondary version of him, a 2.0 version of that guy with that kind of power and that kind of precision, almost beat Kevin Holland the same way, drops him and then jumps on top and gets armbarred. What if that guy wasn't making those grappling mistakes? How good could he be? Well, you're seeing it. So, yeah, I mean, it's up to him to prove how good he is come Saturday night, but I think this is a winnable spot for him.
Hondo P. Moving on down, we got Mel Costa taking on Morgan Charrier. Say it right, Frenchie. Melk and Charrier, I believe it's pretty much a trade pick'em. Melk, the ever so slight favorite, -115, minus on both sides. Straight pick'em. I don't think I've ever bet Morgan Charrier. And I don't think I could get started now. My God, did he make us pay against Nate Landwehr, though.
We were close. Not close
Nate,
enough.
Nate was coming on. Last thing I thought in my mind was that this Frenchman was going to get a finish of Nate the Train. God damn. God damn. But, like, Melk has never been a guy who really impressed me all that much either. But, like, the submission streak that he's been on, the one against Feely, that one cost me an absolute bag. Long story short, the grappling ability of Melk, I like. Interestingly, what is, like, the length between these two guys? A little bit of a reach advantage for Melk Costa. Volume, I mean, Melk usually doesn't have any sort of like strikes landed per minute advantage over too many guys, and he's got a slight one here. Melk Costa's the side for me. What about you?
Yeah, same thing. Melk Costa seems to have hit like a bit of a stride of sorts. I mean, when you go back to his loss to Steve Garcia, which for the record aged pretty good, since then, I mean, he must have been sick in that fight. He's not trying to strike. He's just holding on to Steve Garcia to the best of his abilities. Gasses after the first, knocked down the second. Since then, the Shaolin Nurmagomedov fight, nice performance. Got taken down a few times, tires him out, takes his back, chokes him out. Feely tripled him up on the striking numbers. Feely took him down. He set up a really weird guillotine choke from half guard. I don't know. Obviously, the guy's got one hell of a grip on him because it made it work, and he choked him out. Christian Rodriguez took him down 6 times. Milk's popping back up. Mm-hmm. And then that last fight with Julian Arosa, he lands over 100 significant strikes. Really, he's got good durability. The guy can take a punch. His submission defense is pretty good. He can wrestle. He can strike. He can throw up some volume. He's very much a generalist. I wouldn't say he's a world-class striker or a world-class grappler. But what he does well is he mixes it all very well, very effectively, has a good blend to his game. When you look at Morgan Charrier, I was always the biggest proponent. If you can get plus money on him, then why not take a shot? Because he's just a very close split decisions right across the board. Thing is they hardly ever give you plus money on him. He's always some big pronounced favorite for no other reason than he's got all the skills in the world as well. His difference is that he just doesn't really put his foot on the gas all that much. Now, that Nate Landwehr fight his last time out, yeah, he absolutely knocked him out. It was in Nashville. Nate Landwehr heard the crowd, knew this was his chance, and just got a little bit reckless and walked into a shot against Charrier. The guy can crack. The guy's got excellent striking, good scramble ability. Just seems like his range is against Nate Landwehr, he landed 67. Mm-hmm. Against Nathaniel Wood, 42. Against Gabriel Miranda, it's a second round finish, but only 19 to that point. Against Chepe, went the distance. He had landed 49. It just feels a tad low. It feels like he's so skilled that he waits a little bit too long. Either he's looking to counter, hey, you lead the dance, and I'm going to counter off of that. Or when it's his turn to lead the dance, it's no more than a 1-1-2. Milk, size-wise, is not any bigger, but I think he's got a really nice left body kick, and he should be able to cause Sherrier to kind of react to that, drop his hands, mix in some takedowns, try to press the guy against the cage. This is very much a 50-50 fight. To me, it just seems like Milk Costa is more prone to maybe keep up a higher level of offense, not get chin-checked, mix in a few takedowns, try to really slow this guy down to the best of your ability, and make it work that way. So, again, 50-50, you can make a strong argument on both sides. Got a lot of respect for Sherrier. He just doesn't necessarily do enough at times. Whereas Milk Costa, not the most skilled guy, but has the desire. Oftentimes, he's just outwilling his opponent by being the one to go forward. And I think that that's going to be the key here. So Milk Costa by decision. The other path here would be just to take the fight to go over 2.5 or to go to decision, but yep. It's probably going to be a fairly violent fight for the most part. So not exactly the easiest ticket to hit either.
No. Costa by decision is like plus 150. I don't hate that. Moving on down, we've got Kennedy and Zetchikwu taking on Marcus Buchecha Almeida. Minus 126. Market has really collapsed on this one. It was minus 200 kind of as an opener for Kennedy. And I think a lot of, you know, Buchecha backers are going like, hey, you know, this is a former 205 pounder in Kennedy and Zetchikwu, who's very, very tall, but maybe the wrestling, the grappling, the world-class jiu-jitsu will work for a guy like Buchecha in this fight. Now it's out of pick 'em. I don't really like the money line, but I still think, I mean, it's pretty square. You know, nothing, we're not reinventing the wheel here, but the plus 240, plus 230 Buchecha by sub is of interest to me in this fight. Where are you at with this fight, Coates?
Yeah, honestly, I didn't think I would be betting Marcus Buchecha, especially after that last time, because I did take him in his UFC debut. But I told myself after that, no more, never again. And here we are, Paul Shaughnessy, about to do the goddamn thing one more time. So, yeah, it really does come down to a matchup for sure. Marcus Buchecha, BJJ world champion, a little bit older now at 35, but at heavyweight, 35 is not exactly a death sentence. Has some high level fighting experience from one championship. Maybe we can like this. Maybe we can get into this. But yeah, the bottom line is they booked him against Martin Budai in his UFC debut. Budai is every bit of 265 pounds. And the fight's also in Abu Dhabi. So it's a big arena and it's really hot and there's a lot of pressure and there's a big crowd. And this is supposed to be an easy victory for Marcus Buchecha and everything collapses. So for them to rebook him in a sophomore outing, I expect him to look better the second time around. I expect him to look better, not with this big long gap and a promotional hiatus. And now he's booked in the Apex where there's no crowd and there's no bright lights and there's no big pressure. I do feel like all he really needs is a takedown and he should be able to go to work. For Kennedy Njoku, his last time out, he took on Walter Walker. And you and I both picked Walter Walker. And then somebody in the comment section, I don't know, somebody pointed out, they're like, you guys are wrong on this one because the path of victory for Walter Walker is just fall on the leg. Mm-hmm. And check out Kennedy Njoku's social media. He's been competing in a lot of jiu-jitsu tournaments lately, like a ton of them. He knows what Walter Walker is going to want to do is grapple. And he's been extensively working on his grappling. So I said, count me in. I go and I look on social media and Kennedy's been competing at a lot of grappling tournaments as a blue belt. He's a blue belt. And even though he's a UFC veteran, he's competing in blue belt tournaments. And so he takes on Walter Walker, who just falls back on the leg and subs immediately. Well, I don't really think Marcus Buchecha is going to fall back on a leg as much as, yeah, he's a black belt. And the difference between you and Martin Budai is that Martin Budai is a meatball of a man. He's a bowling ball. He probably cuts from 280. And although he's not really good in any one area, he's not bad in any one area. He's hard to take down. He's hard to hold down. And then as you start to tire, he starts to take over.
Shish is 20 pounds heavier.
Should be 20 pounds heavier considering the last time we saw Njoku, he weighed in at 238, right? Mm-hmm. Coming in here, he's naturally the 205er, but also with his very high center of gravity, being that he's so tall, these body lock takedowns should work a lot better. Being able to just kind of duck under and try to get to the hips should be a little bit easier. And when you've got Marcus Buchecha on top of you and you've got these long limbs, it's hard to create space. It's hard to scramble. Do you have enough power to knock this guy out? Yeah, you got enough power to knock this guy out. But Bouchesh is not really showing like a terrible chin. He went the distance with Umar Rugrug Khan in one championship. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for better or for worse, he looked awful. But he did go to the decision with Martin Budai as well. In fact, had a moment in the third round where he got the fight to the ground, just was far too gassed out at that point. So if he can take some of these early shots from Kennedy and Jaku, close the distance, it's a small cage. It's in the apex. This guy doesn't have a ton of space to work with. And your entire win condition is get into the clinch. And so I do feel like he's got a better chance of getting to that position, getting this fight to the ground, and then going to shop on top. As you said, the submission prop, it's always going to be in play when you got a guy like Marc Bouchesha, but especially so if you're taking on a guy like Kennedy and Jaku, who maybe lacks some of these nuances to his jiu-jitsu game and is maybe prone to making a mistake and getting caught from a guy like Martin Budai. So Kennedy's just kind of a guy that's been looking for his home. He's 8-6 in the UFC. He was fighting at 205, not working out. They say come to heavyweight. His wins at heavyweight are Chris Barnett and Lucas Brzezinski. You can make the argument that he's actually never won a fight at heavyweight if those are the numbers that, or those are the opponents that you're getting fed. So
remember when he lost to OSP? Like, look at the stats of that OSP split decision loss. Yeah. And he was like he's a monster favorite in that fight. That was the moment that I realized, you know, this minus 700 favorite against OSP. And what's OSP done since then?
Yeah, you know, the one that really caught me was
he went out there and got subbed by Ryan Spann in the first round in his follow-up fight. And then he's just like, no mas. It's game over. That's the end of the OSP.
Yeah, Kennedy's got the win over Carlos Olberg. That's his high moment. The guy beat the crap out of me for
because Olberg didn't know how to maintain, because Olberg had been running through everybody through his entire, you know, the early part of his career. That the one moment that he didn't absolutely just kill somebody, he gassed himself out.
That's and that's kind of the thing, is that he had that high mark win, and then after that he lost to Dong Jung as a slight favorite. He lost to Nikolai Nigamariani, which is certainly not a good look. And then after that, yeah, OSP or Dustin Jacoby, you can give him a pass on that. At least they were, you know, former title challengers or former top ranked guys. I got a lot of respect for Dustin Jacoby, right? Those are the type of fights you can lose, but it just feels like at light heavyweight he was an athletic specimen, so much length, and he never made it work for himself. Now at heavyweight, it's not as if he's filled this frame and suddenly he's this giant guy. He still fights a little bit slow. He's a little bit awkward. He's a little bit plodding at times. And I do think that when you're giving up 20 pounds to the other thing is, it's not like it's Bouchesha coming in here making his UFC debut where there's going to possibly be jitters, or he's been off a layoff, or, you know, he's not used to this style of fighting. It's in a cage and not a ring. Those are all things that affected him in his debut. It's almost certainly going to get a slightly better version this time. And I think even a slightly better version would be enough to secure a victory. So if you were able to get better plus money on it a few days ago, yeah, buddy, I see it. But even right now, you're still getting plus money. And so the play for me is Marcus Bouchesha.
Yep. All right. We got King Green taking on Lance Gibson Jr. Short notice fight. So hence, it's a catch weight. I believe it's a catch weight of 160 odds on this fight. We got Bobby Green. King Green, not updated. On the best or the fight odds .io or .pro there. -220 favorite, Gibson +185. You have thoughts on this fight?
Yeah, I mean, I got thoughts on this fight, but with Lance Gibson, it's like I honestly thought this kid would be somewhere by now. He's absolutely shredded. His dad's Lance Gibson Sr., who fought in the UFC. His stepmom is Julia Budd, who could have fought in the UFC, but basically was a Bellator champion and fought for PFL and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Kids is in nasty good shape. I mean, they're buddies with Rampage Jackson. They're buddies with all these guys out in Seattle, Mark Hume. He's spent time at AMC Pancration. He's learned from Demetrius Johnson. This kid's going to be an absolute stud, and they've slow played him every step of the way. Bellator signed him when he was just 2-0, but he fought Dominic Jones, 2-2. Marcus Surin, Raymond Pena, Nainoa Dung, who actually gave him a go. Dominic Clark, 15-12, and that's actually a big win for him. And then Vladimir Tokov knocks him out in the first round. Bellator is done after that. He had turned down a significant amount of fights at Bellator. They haven't really wanted to fight any of the top guys. The first time he took a step up in a top 10 guy in Tokov, he got TKO'd in a single round. He's asking for too much money. They released him. And since then, he's just been floating around no man's land competing for Muckleshoot Fight Night, beating 19-42 Sharon Spain before beating RJ Hoyt his last time out. I know for a fact that he was offered a fight with Hunter Lee a month ago and they turned it down. So how he suddenly got into the UFC, I'm not sure. Couldn't really tell you. Could he win this fight? Yeah, on one hand, and you watch him fight, he's a smooth operator. He wrestled at Arizona State University. He's got some decent grappling chops to him. He's a career lifelong martial artist. Kid grew up on the mats. His father's a career long martial artist. His stepmom is a career long martial artist. That clearly he's got the grappling. And again, physical specimen. Can wrestle. Can get you to the ground. Against Bobby Green, that would be the play. No way in hell is he going to try to stand with Bobby Green. He's going to try to take him down, smother him, try to get the submission, but if not, just win a few rounds. The problem for me is that since Bellator cut him 2.5 years ago, he's only fought twice. And both guys are very, very low level of competition, both of whom who he finished in the first round. No major promotion's been interested in signing him. I don't know that he's had an extended fight camp. Now you're jumping in there and making your UFC debut. It's short notice for him. I know this because he was being offered regional show fights as of a month ago. So for Bobby Green, the end is definitely getting there. He's 39 years old. His last fight against Mauricio Ruffi, you're probably not going to be the same after a fight like that. The fight with Jalen Turner, I really didn't think he'd be the same after a fight like that. No doubt he's slowing down. No doubt he's not the same guy he used to be. And no doubt the path of victory would be take him down and smash him on the ground. But he's got a lot of experience. He's got a lot of back class. He's fought in just infinitely better guys than Lance Gibson Jr. And he's got a viable path of victory that he's a better striker than him. So really, it's going to be coming down to, can Bobby Green keep this fight standing? And I think that A, he can. Onwards of the first round. First round will be tough. Lance Gibson a little bit bigger, maybe a little bit stronger than him. Muscles him around a little bit. Second and the third round, this kid's not been to a second and the third round in like 3 years. The last time Lance Gibson Jr. had been past the very first round was 2022. So it's been 3.5 years since he's been past the first round. And now he's coming in on 4 weeks' notice, making his UFC debut. There'll be an adrenaline dump. There'll be fatigue setting in. And whereas Bobby Green's chin is not what it used to be, this kid doesn't really got any huge power. He's mostly trying to get you to the ground and out grapple you. So I think it's a good live betting spot for King Bobby, and that get him out of the first round, then start to take over. But yeah, like Vladimir Tokov, if anybody remembers that fight, it's a jab. He jabs him and Lance Gibson Jr. hits the deck. Similar to Bobby Green jabbing Grant Dawson. Holy shit, you think I'd have learned my lesson on that one, eh? Such an idiot. Point being, is Bobby can knock this guy out, or Bobby could just outwork him on the feet. It's all about keeping it standing. If you gave me Lance Gibson with a full training camp, you gave me Lance Gibson who had already had a couple fights in the UFC and his feet were starting to get wet, maybe he's got a better chance of doing that. But in this debut, this is the chance to expose him, catch him before he gets going. So, yeah, maybe it's a donation, but I'll take King Bobby Green.
Yeah, and that last time that he was two decision was against Nainoa Dung. I don't know anything about that person. But it sounds like shit.
Yeah, dung sounds like shit, doesn't it? No.
Thank God you caught the joke I was dropping there. I was waiting for you to finish. So once that went through my head, that's what I'm here for, to provide that type of levity to the conversation.
To drop the poo jokes. Yeah, well, you know what? I'm here for it. Nice. That Nainoa Dung fight. Yeah, it was. Yeah, this is years ago at this point, so I don't know. I think that the opportunity will be there, but and plus steroid testing is now on the table as well. Keep your eyes open.
But short notice, maybe get around that, and then we find out, a month from now that he actually pissed hot. He's out for a year and a half.
Well, it's a catch weight of 160. Now, why would it be a catch weight of 160, right? But because this kid's jumping in on short notice and he's not able to get down. I would imagine Bobby Green, who's never had issues in the past with making the weight and is always in shape, and it's coming near Christmas, and Bobby Green would like to get one more payday before the year closes. He's gone from fighting Mauricio Ruffi, Paddy Pimblett, Jim Miller, Jalen Turner, Grant Dawson, Tony Ferguson, Jared Gordon, Drew Dober, Islam Makhachev, Nasrat Haqparast, Ali Quinta, Rafael Fiziev, Thiago Moises. All of those guys I just named, I rate higher than Lance Gibson Jr. So I understand Bobby's not what he used to be, but this is a step down from him. And if he can't capitalize here, then it really is the end.
Yeah, he had to pull out of the fight in August, right? With Diego Ferreira. I remember a social media post, a video of him pulling out of that fight. I think it had to do with an injury or his body wouldn't cut or something. He's just like, listen, I'm not that guy. I don't dodge people. I don't step out of fights, but my body just kind of shut down. I believe that's what happened, if memory serves correct.
Yeah, he did pull out due to injury, but speaking of, I'm not
that's what it says guy. On Tapology, but like, I think it was something else. Like, I think it was like close to like fight week that he pulled out.
Yeah, like, it was like the exact reason, but he's not wrong. He's definitely not avoiding anybody. Remember that video of Armin Sarukian? And it's Bobby's all by himself. Armin's there with like five of his goons, and it's like, Bobby's in for it, dude. I'm for it. Let's get this thing cracking.
Pulling the trigger on Bobby Green minus 220. That wasn't on my bingo card like 2 days ago. But
well, again, it's another fight that you're probably going to want to
just bet all the dogs. Doesn't necessarily work. Bobby Green's the side for me too. Jillian Robertson taking on Amanda Lamas. Robertson minus 220 favorite to come back on Lamas plus 170. Your thoughts?
I'm going to go with Jillian Robertson, being that she's on a great little win streak right now, but her ability to just get the fights to the ground and get it into her wheelhouse. We've always known this girl's been able to grapple, training a long time under Dean Thomas and getting some specialized looks. She spent time at ATT. She spent time at the Goat Shed, but it really just feels like the last little bit she's been honing in her training camp to just being a lot more specialized. How can we get these fights exactly where we want them? And that's where we're going to capitalize. Her against Marina Rodriguez, 2. Against Luana Pinheiro, 5. Against Michelle Watterson, 2. Against Pollyanna Viana, 2. Against Tabitha Ricci, 1. She's taken down every single one of her opponents. The last time she did not take an opponent down was Taylor Santos. That was 5 years ago. Since then, she's been completing at least one takedown in all of her fights. The difference is that there was a time where she would get a takedown, maybe not win the first round, and then she starts to fall apart. Now she's been a lot more like conservative. She gets the first round takedown. She's not overly trying to rush. She's on record many times back in the day being like, it's position, it's submission over position for me. If I win a fight, but I don't finish, it doesn't feel like a win to me. I'm more than willing. When I get on top, I go for the submission. And as a result, sometimes you're giving up a good spot. Sometimes you're getting reversed because you got a little too eager. Seems like she's kind of shored that part of her game up, and she's okay with now going to decision if need be. The submission opens itself up. Great. If it doesn't, we're going to hold down position, win the round, land some ground and pound, rack up some points, and do it that way. Amanda Lemos, meanwhile, she's big, she's strong, she's physical, but I think the takedown defense is absolutely there to get exploited. Her last three losses, her last one was Tatiana Suarez, who just took her down 3 times, held position. No doubt Tatiana gassed. No doubt Tatiana did not look good in that third round, and Amanda Lemos is big, strong, rugged, and coming forward. But she lost the first two rounds fairly easily because she's getting taken down. Verna Jandiroba took her down once and just put on an absolute grappling clinic, eventually submitting her. Zhang Weili took her down 6 times, absolutely neutralized her over the course of 5 rounds. That's what you got to do. Now, Robertson, it will be similar to Tatiana Suarez. Suarez is a much better wrestler, but Jillian Robertson is a much better grappler. So she'll get the takedowns. She'll hold position. But Lemos is a dog. And by the third round, if Jillian's sucking wind and Jillian's slowing down, Lemos is going to be trying to take her head off and score that TKO. I just feel like she'll be fighting 2 rounds out of the hole at that point. And if she does, even if she just has a big third round and wins the third round, without the finish, she'll end up losing on the scorecards. It's in the apex. It's small. Jillian's going to be able to hear exactly what her corner is telling her. She's going to be able to exactly follow the advice. And the flip side to that for Lemos, she feeds off the crowd. Oh, she got back up. Oh, we don't want to see a grappling match. Knock her out, knock her out. That energy, oh, that they loved it. I got back up to my feet and the place went crazy. Yeah, I'm feeling good now. Now I am actually going to smash her with a few elbows and try to knock this girl out. Yeah, that's kind of off the table. You get back up and it's cricket, 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 cricket. I think the last Apex event, you could hear the AC unit on. It's like, that's what you're hearing in the venue. That's not great for I'm down 2 rounds and they need this come from behind third round knockout. So I do feel like Jillian probably gets the position, her preferred positions that she'd like, hold it down, soften her up. If you can grab a sub, great. But I would honestly rather you hang out in half guard, pin her to the mat, land some short chopping elbows and secure the decision victory. But again, Robertson will do what she has to do. I do feel like that the game plans have improved. Her physicality has improved. And she should be good enough to win the first two and coast in the third.
Yeah, it's been a while since Jillian got a sub, to be perfectly honest. She's went for subs, but hasn't been able to complete it in a bunch of her fights, because that seemed to be most of her path to victory in her earlier fights. But as you said, a seismic shift in her mentality. It all kind of makes sense to me. Lamont's always very, very low volume. Takedown defense has been improving for sure, but yeah, it was a very disappointing, as a lifelong fan of Tatiana Suarez, it was a very disappointing performance for her. Was able to get the takedowns, and when she did get the takedown, she was able to hold those positions, but getting those takedowns seemed a little bit difficult over the course of it. And I will add, the one thing that I will say is that Jillian Robertson, from everything I see, seems to be a much better striker than my girl Tatiana Suarez at this point in her career as well. So more volume and able to put it together a little bit more, mix it up a little bit more than Suarez. So maybe in being able to mix it up with the hands a little bit, that's where you get to the hips. That's where you get the takedown. That's where you get the control time. Jillian Robertson's the pick for me as well, leaning towards decision. Which is like plus 230 seems like a half decent prop there. I know that Lamas was subbed with a guillotine by Jessica Andrade, or arm triangle by Jessica Andrade. So it's there.
It was a standing arm triangle too.
Yeah, that was a bad one. That was a bad one. And then and Verna. I mean, Verna's just an absolute master.
Verna's
the man. So no real shame in that. Jillian Robertson still kind of getting those, like, you know, she's one of those girls that the prop market tends to still really give her like a lot of finish equity. So her by decision seems somewhat sneaky, and I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, realm of possibility is a weird way to say it. I think it's probably the most likely outcome, and I don't know if it's necessarily price is the most likely outcome. So, yeah, G-Rob by a decision for me. We got Yaroslav Amosov taking on Neil Magny. Amosov minus 400 favorite. The comeback on Magny plus 300. Your thoughts?
Well, if you're going to bet Neil Magny, obviously just wait for the third round to start. And that's where Neil Magny time takes over. And then he does his thing. But with Amosov, it's like, I truly do believe this guy is one of the great fighters that was unsigned to the UFC. If your game plan is to take him down, you've almost got next to no shot. His counter defense, defensive wrestling, his ability to keep wrestlers forced to strike with them, it's second to none, man. He's fought a lot of wrestlers. Gerald Harris is a wrestler. Ed Ruth was a 3-time national champion. Logan Storley was a 6-time state champion. These guys don't even come close to taking him down. They can't. His takedown defense is rock solid. And then after he beats Douglas Lima, which is a killer victory, as the war breaks out, or at least it intensifies between Russia and Ukraine, he then takes 2 years off, fought as a part of the Ukrainian army. There's that video of him. He buried his belts in like this rubble. He like goes back to this bunker, goes down, unwraps his bag, and pulls out his Bellator title. It's like, hi, yeah, it's still here. It's like, wow, man, that's crazy that you go from training every day at America Top Team twice a day, that war breaks out in your home country, and he's enough of a patriot that it's like, I need to go over there and handle business. That it's going to be pretty distracting, and I can't say he's looked all himself since he's come back. His fight with Jason Jackson, the difference there is that Jason Jackson's not trying to take him down. So therefore, he's now forced to strike with Jackson. And I don't know, his timing looked off. His durability looked off. It looked like he got tired after the first round. His feet were never really underneath him. Could you make an excuse for him and say his head's in another place? It certainly looked like his head was in another place. And then after that, he goes and he takes another nearly 2 years off. Comes back against Curtis Melender in his last fight. And he looked good. But really, he's not been super active the last little bit. He's not probably showing up in the best shape. He's not had a full training camp, so to speak. And so it's hard to definitively say that he's going to be the best version of himself. And the thing with Neil Magny is that he's got more experience than anybody, really, at this point. He is able to take you to the deeper waters. And he's got multiple ways to beat you. He's got a nasty submission game. His striking, although not the biggest power guy, once he starts to rack up strikes on you, he really keeps you at the end of his shots, right? And he'll start to hurt you, cause you to make a desperate move, shoot a desperate shot, and that's where he snatches you up. Magny can sub you. He can TKO you. There's fights like that Jake Matthews fight his last time out. I understand there's a lot of controversy and he nearly got stopped in the first round. But the bottom line is, by the end of that fight, he's really beating up Jake Matthews standing. This causes Jake to take the bad shot. This causes Jake to get desperate and to end up with Neil Magny on top of him. So Liza Zaleski de Santos, same thing. He loses the first round. Second round, he starts to pick up. He starts to come back. He starts to hurt him. Once he gets on top of him, he's able to put him away. If for whatever reason, Amislav's not in good shape or he's not in optimum shape, then Neil Magny presents a tough problem for everybody. But for me, the reason why I'm going to end up taking Amislav is I just think that Neil Magny is best when he's mixing in his grappling, when he's able to control you up against the cage, when he's able to tire you out. And with Amislav, he's not getting taken down. So now you got Neil Magny striking versus Amislav striking. And although Neil Magny is definitely serviceable, he's a little bit older now. He's a little bit more ginger. His striking is usually only comes alive once you start to tire. And if you don't start to tire, then I don't necessarily see him working his way back into this. Matthews tired out, made a mistake. Zaleski de Santos got tired, made a mistake. Mike Malott got tired, made a mistake. Those other guys, Ian Gary, Michael Morales, Carlos Prates, all top guys. Top guys show up in top shape. Amislav is that guy. It's just hard to definitively say he's in great shape. He is the play for me, but if I get Neil Magny again, I can't say I'm going to be overly surprised. The third round's always a sweat. I just do feel like Amislav is going to be able to secure these first two, coast out the third if need be. Or truthfully, if he just takes Neil Magny down, gets on top, he might be able to sub him. He might be able to soften him up and find an opening for something. It's just, it's always tough. I had a talk with a buddy this morning. It's always tough when you see these guys making their UFC debut versus a guy that's got 30 fights in the UFC. You know, there's a big experience advantage. You can be a Bellator champ. You can have killed a guy in Ukraine. You could have seen a bunch of crazy things that'll get you ready for a fight. But it's different kind of when you're fighting in the UFC. Now, this is the apex. There's no crowd. There's no bright lights. There's no none of that. But Magny's a guy that's fought in huge arenas and no arenas. He's seen it all, right? For Amislav, does he need the crowd? Does he need the vibe? Is he going to be motivated? Is traveling to Las Vegas and going through this weight cut and experiencing all these things and doing a media day, like, is that going to affect him? Hard to say. But for me, I'm going to take the ride with him and say that this is one of the guys that I always used to say, if you take the best Bellator champs, they absolutely factor in and can fight the best guys in the UFC. Amislav was one of the best Bellator champs. I expect him to be able to compete with the top 10 guys in the UFC. Neil Magny is a gatekeeper to the stars. He's not really a top 10 guy. So, yeah, give me Amislav here.
Too many question marks. If I have anything that I took away from your breakdown, is that there's too many question marks for me to be laying minus 400.
Yeah, the price is not great.
No. Dogger pass. Neil Magny at plus 300 is never.
Live bet him after the first round.
Yeah, of course, of course. Let's just bet it live. See if he doesn't get knocked or doesn't get killed early, because we have seen Magny killed early in some fights. But you know Magny, the cardio always checks out. He's got a 5-inch reach advantage. Doesn't have very much power, but this is just the ultimate generalist. He's kept his job for being a gatekeeper just like this. So we'll see. We'll see how good Bellator is.
You're not wrong, man. You want to talk about...
As the fight gets extended. Like, I'm looking through, like... Logan Storley, if he came over to the UFC, would get absolutely trounced. Like, we've been betting him on PFL and Bellator for years and stuff like that. Just like...
He's not UFC.
Yeah. He is not UFC level. His wrestling is okay. Can't strike for a damn. I don't know if his cardio is even that elite, to be perfectly honest. There's not many wins on this record that, like, really, really... Like, sure, Curtis Millender, Anaconda Choke on CFFC.
Ah, Curtis.
It's the one fight he's had in 3 years since getting ass-kicked by the ass-kicking machine.
Right, and speaking of that one, Paul, when you talk about Neil Magny, maybe not the biggest power guy, Jason Jackson is not. Not at all. These were his fights leading into that. Split decision win over Hermerson Souza. Split decision over Ed Ruth. Went the distance with Kichi Kunimoto. Went the distance with Jordan Mean. Went the distance with Benson Henderson. Went the distance with Naaman Gracie. Went the distance with Paul Daly. Went the distance with Douglas Lima. Knocked the absolute shit out of Yaroslav Amosov. So maybe he doesn't have much of a chin on him. It's not the kind of minus 400 you want to take. So yeah, maybe this is my bad pick of the week where I definitely not putting him on all the way at the top, but I got a feeling I don't want to jump into the Neil Magny business on this one. Cost me dearly against Jake Matthews, but in another universe, I had a first round finish in that one. So, you know, it's just the way betting goes, and it's the way MMA goes. It can go every which way. Expect the unexpected.
Hondo P. Now we get into the nitty gritty. This card here, we got Steven Asplin taking on Sean Sharaf, the highest level of heavyweight tilts that the UFC could possibly put this far down. An offering. I'm obviously being sarcastic for anybody who's watching. Asplin, minus 235 favorite to come back on Sharaf, plus 200. How are you approaching this fight, Cody?
Yeah, well, this one is a same thing as you could look at a guy that made his short notice debut in Sean Sharaf and actually looked okay for the first 4 minutes and then loses. And now you're expecting a better version of him. Full training camp this time around. He's not coming in at ultra short notice. Maybe he's going to be able to extend that and look a little bit better. And truly, when Sean Sharaf made his UFC debut against Junior Toffoli, he didn't look terrible. That first round, that first 4 minutes, let's say, until the wheels absolutely fell off on him.
I bet him. I felt smart. I felt smart for a few minutes. I bet him as like a pretty big underdog against Junior Taffa. And then the wheels fell off.
Yeah, he got a takedown. He got into a good spot. He's landing. This is a training partner of Sean Strickland. He's full-time in Las Vegas. But to this point, he was 4-0. And all four of his wins are inside the first round. So in this fight with Junior, it's the same thing. He looks good for 4 minutes, and as soon as it got to that second, he fell right apart. Now, hey, it was an inspiring performance. You ran on less than a week's notice, and it's your debut, and you only had four pro fights. And don't worry, let's just go right back in there and do it all over again. But he's now taken off 14 months. So are we expecting a better version of him? Yeah, sure we are. But at the same time, he's not been competing. He's not racked up a few more fights. He's not had to go to a second round and a third round and really test that cardio. So it's kind of hard to definitively say that he's made any type of real improvement. Steve Asplin, meanwhile, this guy's 6'5", but he moves like the wind, baby. Like, he is one of these Tim Sylvia. He's obviously not a great athlete.
He used to be a fat dude, and then he lost a bunch of weight. Hence why he's got, titties. But he makes fun of his titties. It's funny. He's got a real character. Like, he's a real character. Like, if you ever watch his interviews.
Deprecation, for sure. He's really harsh on himself. But, yeah, he's one of these guys that I probably got bullied because I was the fat kid, and now I'm the guy with the fat titties. And, buddy, say something to my face and see what happens. I'm 6'5", with a 78-inch reach, weigh 265 pounds.
His dad was a fighter, too, wasn't it?
His dad was a fighter. I always thought his dad would make it to the UFC as one of these guys that goes 0-1 and 0-2. Because he was 15-2, but he was just an absolute can crusher royale. But it goes back to this second generation fighter where his dad's fighting for Bellator. His dad fought for Titan FC. I think his dad fought Brett Rogers at one time. You go through those trials and tribulations. You learn things. What did you do right? What did you do wrong? What are the type of training partners you need? What's the type of diet you need? And here, now Junior's kind of absorbed that all in. He was not supposed to win his fight on the Contender Series where he came in as a short notice underdog, but really it's this LFA run. This is a bottom of the barrel level of heavyweight, but realistically, Billy Ray Valdez, Larry Gonzalez, Denzel Freeman, Hammer Morton, those are the unsigned heavyweights. Like, if you're fighting on the regional scene, those are the guys. And so for him, it's like he can fight a second round. He can fight a third round. He moves pretty well. He's gotten fast hand speed on him, but also he's 6-1. He's going to be prone to make mistakes. His only losses to Denzel Freeman, who was a standout wrestling champion, who was able to take him down and choke him out, and is now 1-0 in the UFC himself. Terrible debut. But all the same, is, you know, a UFC quality of guy. I look at Steve Asplin, I think here's a mobile heavyweight who's going to be able to use some reach, keep you to the outside as you're trying to enter the pocket. You know, he's got fast hand speed. And then once this fight hits the ground, I mean, he's a big body. He's hard to peel down. He's hard to hold down. And in the second and the third round, as you start to slow down, that's kind of where he starts to shine. His cardio really isn't that bad. You can watch these fights on the regional scene. And yes, it sometimes look like he's Bambi on ice. He's struggling to find his footing. But when you're two heavyweights locked in a small cage and you have less than 10 pro fights, a lot of the times you're swinging. A lot of times you're making these slight mistakes. It's how you continue to evolve and how you continue to grow. And I think he's doing all that stuff well. Sean Sharaf has got that shorter stature. He's 6'3", but he's going to be looking to take him down, and he's going to be looking to land some big ground and pound, hold him down, try to take him out early. Once that fails to materialize, and it doesn't mean he's not going to take him down and beat him up for the first 3 minutes. It's after this gets past 3 minutes and you start to slow, or the first round ends and now the second round starts and you guys are both on your feet and this takedown becomes a lot harder to get. That's at the point that he's going to get rolled over. So I think Sean Schroff gets knocked out, Steve Asplund by TKO. I'd be tempted to take a one and a, over 1.5. I'd be tempted to take an Asplund by TKO in the second, something of that nature. But it just depends what kind of price they're going to offer you.
It's like that Raiden, because like we break down like a whole bunch of like regional and stuff. And we were on Asplund against Raiden Kovacs. And I remember watching that one and feeling like a complete moron. Because like Kovacs is like a big body dude. He's like 6'6" or something like that.
6'6".
He stinks, but like big, strong. And like that's what he wants to do is grapple. And like he got Asplund down and like, we're laying like -7. Like people are like, what the hell? Like, why do we have this guy in all of our parlays type of thing? And, you know, Asplund came through, got the job done for the boys. But like, yeah, this fight could play out very, very similarly. You may be asking yourself. But the one good thing that Asplund has going for him is that, one, yes, he is very mobile. Two, he's 27-year-old heavyweight. So it's like he's still making improvements. And that durability hasn't really been checked whatsoever for him. You just got to stay in the fight. But yeah, -235 pre-flop doesn't get me all that excited. Looking for like a round two prop, something like that. That may be how I get involved in this. But live betting could be the best way to approach this, because I've watched enough Asplund this year to know that, yeah, the takedown defense is definitely a question mark, and it takes him a while to get himself into the fight. So I don't know if I'm going to be getting to this pre-flop number at -230 or whatever, but live betting, maybe a round two or round three type of prop is the way that I would go about betting Steven Asplund versus Sean Sharaf. We got Luana Santos taking on Melissa the Scare Croden, -125 for Santos. The comeback on Croden, +105. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I didn't give Croden the biggest shot to win her debut. Again, a fighter that's kind of been waiting on the sidelines, and a lot of opportunities failed to materialize. She's not been the most active. And yeah, she goes in there and fights at home. UFC's in Canada, it's in BC. Go out and capitalize. And she very much did. Lost the first round. And then as Tanera Lisboa starts to slow down, then Melissa Croden started to pick up the pace. Good volume in that fight. Very physically strong. Mixed in some takedowns. She does have like a traditional karate style where you'll see her a little bit with the side stance, bladed at times. You know, use some side kicks. Use some, you know, a lot of range kicks. But really, I mean, she is strong, physical in the clinch. Able to muscle you down to the ground. You know, decent power in her hands. And just all around someone that's going to go out there and try to give you an all-around performance. Really just bully your opponent if she's possible. Luana Santos, meanwhile, I just feel like she is younger, faster. Takedown defense should be good enough to keep this fight upright. And if it is upright, she's the better striker. The difference is that she's very low volume. So I don't know definitively that she's not able to keep Croden away from taking her down. And now we've got a striking contest where she's landing some decent shots straight up the middle without the ability to take Croden down, which maybe she can. But if she can't, she may just be getting outworked, and you'll see the number on Croden is starting to wind down. Like, she was a bigger underdog a few days ago, and now it does seem like there's some money coming in on it. So it's kind of CF dot model. You could see either girl having their moments and winning it. You'd kind of rather be holding the ticket with the plus money, but maybe I'm just a Croden hater. I kind of find myself falling back into the Luana Santos train of thought, is that she's young and she's making improvements. I do feel like she's got the better overall grappling, and that last fight with where she also fought Tanera Lisboa, it's low volume, I get it. But when she does get the fight to the ground, that's where she seems to shine a little bit. You could definitely see this thing going either way. I'm not confident really at all. I just kind of feel like Luana Santos is getting in better quality work, making some better improvements fight to fight, and it maybe greases this thing out. When the line opened up, probably just a pass altogether. Now that it's about 50-50, still a pass really, but I think for the purpose of the show, I'm going to take Luana Santos.
She went 2-for-2 against Lisboa on takedowns, getting 7 minutes and 57 seconds of control time. So it's like once she got the takedown, and like those 15 of 19 significant strikes they don't really factor in all of the groundwork that she did. She's 50 of 57 on total strikes. So, you know, probably a lot of pitter patter type of stuff, but still, you know, it's something. And Lisboa, I mean, Cronin was taken down twice by Lisboa.
Bingo.
That's a big problem. Here, we're Canadian. We sometimes people are like, oh, they're only picking those guys because they're Canadian. I'm gonna break that narrative right here. If you're gonna give me a Brazilian versus a Canadian at a near pick'em, and this fight's not in like Edmonton Canada. Or something, yeah. And like I don't have to worry about like home cooking, I'm taking the Brazilian all day. Luana Santos is the pick. Easy. Alan Fry takes on Guilherme Pat in the How Did You Guys End Up Here fight of the night. Low-level heavyweights, one from the Carolina regional scene, other from Brazil. And Guilherme Pat is like a minus 175 favorite. Do you have a thought on this fight, Cody?
Yeah, not overly. I mean, you've got Alan Fry, he's coming out of Derek Brunson's camp in Carolina. So, I mean, the thought process here is that if you've ever seen Derek Brunson fight, it's get the thing finished as quick as you can. And this is what this guy does, man. All of his fights so far have been inside the distance. Generally, last three have been inside the first round. You look at the level of opponent, 2-3, Cody Beck, 2-2, Ryan Show. His last time out, Justin Frazier, 12-3. And Justin Frazier hadn't fought in 6 years leading into that fight. So you go from fighting the absolute bottom of the barrel to you are now fighting in the UFC. Big enough guy, 6'4". But if Dana White's contender series ran all year long, he'd be a guy that's on that. In fact, the reason why... we would be fading the hell about him, surely. When I look at a guy like we just talked about, Stephen Asplund, the difference there is Stephen Asplund signs up with LFA and they feed him tough opponents.
Yep.
You may laugh at a Larry Gonzalez. You may laugh at a Hammer Morton. Those guys are infinitely better than the level of opposition that Alan Fry has been fighting. True. Now, when you're a big guy and you're throwing punches and you're throwing kicks, it's possible that you can go out there and knock your opponent out. And just like Sean Sharaf, he had a good first 4 minutes. It's everything that happens beyond that 4 minutes where things start to fall apart. So it's hard to ascertain how good Alan Fry really is. He doesn't really have much of a wrestling background, but of course you're training with Derek Brunson. I'm sure he's keeping your wrestling up to snuff. Beyond that, he's a front runner. Go out there, finish as fast as you possibly can. With Guilherme Pat being that he's undefeated, it's hard to definitively say, is he chinny? Can he take a punch? I don't know. You watched back his fights. Nobody's really hitting him for the most part. But he's not that good, man. His fight with Mauricio Queiroz, he was a minus 1,000 favorite over. Kind of looked mediocre, went to the third round with him, eventually got him out of there, but didn't look like he was a world beater by any stretch. And then when he was on the Contender Series, supposed to be against Anthony Gourasio, he was a betting underdog prior to pulling out of that fight. So
yeah, but everyone had their wool pulled over their eyes with Gourasio. The guy who trained in his own garage turned out to be the cocky guy, apparently. Who trained in his own garage, I mean, got knocked out by Asplund, and then Larry the Cable Guy won the CFC title, which was not on my bingo card this year for Larry the Cable Guy to get a regional belt, but here we are.
Yeah, I know. To be honest with you, I'd sit here and say I told you so. I was all over Asplund, but I can't say that because I did not think Larry Gonzalez was going to slap him up like that. So my bad. The guy turned out to be no good at all. Point being, though, is that when you've got five pro fights, your biggest win is a guy that was 4-4. Yeah. You've not really been put into these tough spots, so it's tough to see.
Hard to know. Yeah, it's hard to be confident in this fight.
Completely. Yeah, and you could say, well, you've got a better ground game, but you've not really seen it applied. And, you know, he's 6'5" with an 80-inch reach, but he's only 236 pounds. So a guy that's 6'5" at 236 is actually more of a tall and skinny, rangy kind of guy. He's not really looking to use his ground game. Taking on a guy on Alan Fry that's just looking to bum rush you and throw hands as quick as humanly possible. The fact that you were an underdog to Anthony Gourasio, who's also just looking to bum rush you and throws hands as quick as possible. This is a low level heavyweight fight. It's middling. It could go either way, but I want the Brazilian guy. I know this sounds very trivial, but it'd be the same way if it was like, I can't tell you anything about either guy, but I can tell you that the one guy's Russian and the other guy is from Latvia. Well, did you just automatically take the Russian guy? You and I, we see it on the ACA. Sometimes it's like this fight could go either way. The one guy's Peruvian. You tend to maybe take a flyer on the Peruvian, right? It's this Brazil against a can crusher from Carolina.
Yeah, the Carolina regional scene, respectfully, is not great.
Yeah, we got a lot of friends in the South, so I'm not bashing them. It's just, it's the heavyweight
scene. Hey, I'm not bashing them. I know. They know. If you're a hardcore fan, you know your regional scene is not, it's not LFA. It's just not LFA. It is not, LFA is kind of like, is the American wide regional, right? Like they're taking guys from all of the best regionals. It's the step up from the regionals. Getting a win, even if it's a can crushing win on that, it's probably higher than anything that you've done on just the Carolina regional scene. Ooh, there was that one guy who came into Contender Series this year with like an 11-0, like the perfect Kentucky record. Kid. Wasn't he up? I thought he was like South Carolina as well. And he got absolutely flatlined. I forget the guy's name off the top of my head.
I might have been. Yeah, the 145er. I was hoping they'd fight Robbie Ring, who I get it. It's the same thing. It's you kind of got to get out of your comfort zone once in a while, right? And I think that's another part of it here. When you look at this fight with Guillermo Pat has been to decision. Not against a good guy, but he's gone 15 minutes before. His last fight on LFA, it went to the third round. That's all territory that Alan Frey really hasn't been in yet, so. Once the first round ends, if the first round ends, likely it won't. It'll be finished in the first round. But if for whatever reason it gets out of the first round, then skill is right off the table. Now it's going to just be who's got a bigger heart. And you don't know who's got a bigger heart because you've not had to see any guy really face any type of actual adversity. So I am going to take the Brazilian Guillermo Pat. Of course, you're going to watch the weigh-ins. I don't know that that's going to give you any more information. You're just going to see two big guys get on the scale and the best man will come by and win. For me, it should be Guillermo Pat. But really, I just don't understand how either guy got on here. Pat was supposed to fight in the Contender Series, okay? But he pulled out. So in what world do you now get rewarded that you pulled out? Don't worry, you don't have to fight in front of Dana. Don't worry, you don't have to beat a guy. Not only do you have to beat a guy, but you have to beat him to Dana's satisfactory, because if it's a decision, you don't get the contract. No. Just pull out and hang out on the sidelines. We'll just give you a contract. And for Fry, you don't have to go fight for a notable organization. You don't have to pick up a signature victory. You don't have to really do anything. It's just, hey, let's slap this thing together. So
this is a glorified Contender Series fight.
Yeah, it absolutely is a glorified Contender Series fight. Just weird placement. It's at the bottom of the card. I get it. And it's a heavyweight fight. Who doesn't want to watch a sloppy-ass heavyweight fight? But the whole idea of UFC quality and UFC caliber, like it means nothing.
100%. We've got Teresa Bleda taking on Jamie Lynn Horth. Bleda, -145 favorite to come back on Horth, +125. Bleda, I'm not entirely sure. I was trying to figure out like why she's been off for so long. She has some sort of injury. I was on her Instagram. Wasn't able to really put two and two together. Girl's strong. She's 24 years old still. So, lots of potential. Horth, obviously very, very strong, but there really is no volume to be spoken of there. I mean, a win over Gabriela Fernandez for Bleda, in hindsight, being 2 years ago when she was only 22, that doesn't look that bad. Getting to the third round with Natalia Silva, that doesn't look all that bad. I'm just kind of spooked by the fact that it's only -145, Cody. I'm fading Canada again here. What about you?
Yeah, so am I. I actually really like Jamie Lynn Horth, but I've always been a big proponent on what's the best part of Horth's game plan is that she's jacked. Oh, man, this girl's strong. She's very, very, very strong. And so if you want to just try to outmuscle her, it ain't going to go well. Haley Cowan's a big girl. Couldn't outmuscle her. Veronica Hardy, way too small. And that was actually a really close fight. Ended up being a split decision. Ivana Petrovic with the judo black belt. And that's where it started to get kind of unraveled. Petrovic took her down twice and damn near won that fight. Ended up being a really close split decision. Against Miranda Maverick, she wasn't able to just outmuscle her. Miranda Maverick's a better grappler. Miranda Maverick is also very physically strong. Against Vanessa Demopoulos, the muscle works again. You can use that. You can kind of hold her up against the cage if you want. You can take her to the ground. You can outwork her. You can score takedowns because Vanessa Demopoulos basically allows everybody to take her down.
And there's a massive size disparity there.
Huge, huge. You got one girl in Vanessa who's moving up a weight class versus another girl who's very heavily muscled. Now, keep in mind, she's not exactly young. She's 35 years old, Jamie Lee Horth. Yep. But even though she comes from a kickboxing background, she's not really all that comfortable. She's very muscular, so a lot of the shots are stagnant. It's not a 2-3 punch combination. It's not something that's very snappy, bang, 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 land with the leg kick. It's not moving in and out. It's plodding, flat-footed, plod, 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 grab a hold of you. The thing with Blada is that she's very physically strong. In fact, that's her best game. I watched her on the Contender Series against that Naira Maya. She went 1-for-1 on takedowns. With the one takedown, she had almost 11 and a half minutes of control time. Just up against the cage. She's not even trying to take you down. She's trying to push you right through that cage. You ain't going nowhere. And then, so it's exactly like you said, Natalia Silva's got a lot of experience, a lot more skill, a lot more well-rounded. You watched a young girl with no other skill set other than I'm physically strong and I can push you up against the cage. Try to do it. It didn't work. Against Gabriela Fernandez, more skills into her game, more comfortableness. She's able to get 3 takedowns. She's able to control the clock. She's able to land 57 significant strikes. She's able to kind of, you know, be a lot more comfortable in there. And I think that's the main thing, is that when you're 23 years old, you're going to be making improvements fight to fight. Now, there has been a layoff, presumably due to injury. Mm-hmm. But time off for a young fighter is not going to change anything. This fight with Horth, it's like, who's got more volume? To be honest with you, I think Blada does. And who's going to have more success in the clinch-type position? To be honest with you, I think Blada does. And so minus 140 seems a little bit off, but I think that's because both girls have a similar style of a lot of clinch warfare.
I think it
a lot
seems off because, like, I thought it was – I think it's short. Like, I feel like if she was coming fresh off of that Gabriela Fernandez fight, she'd be a bigger favorite than minus 140.
Yeah, and I think the 2 years off is going to be good for her, being that you're really young. It's not as if it's like, what have you been doing the last 2 years sitting around? It's like, no, the maturity rates come back up. Your body's starting to set. You figure out training methods. You figure out new techniques. You figure out new things. And then beyond that, it's like, now we're going back into there. Do we have a cardio problem pre-existing? No. But Blada was just very raw. She's very raw in her approach. And again, that's going to happen to someone that has less than 10 pro fights. So it's almost expected. Horth, meanwhile, she's been very dodged, like her brother-in-law is Cole Smith, who fought in the UFC. And for the longest time, it's like him and his brother Cody Smith have been begging online, can anybody find this girl a fight? Nobody will fight her. Can anybody find her a fight? By the time the UFC signed her, though, she already just seemed a little bit old, a little bit long in the tooth, so to speak. So she's been averaging 2 fights a year, and every single fight she's had at this level has gone to decision. 2 of them have been by split decision. They're usually close and competitive. And outside of that Vanessa Demopoulos fight, she's not had like a stellar runaway performance. That was a good style clash for her. This one isn't. This one's going to be a lot closer to the Miranda Maverick fight or the Ivana Petrovic fight, which is her being controlled in the clinch for the most part and kind of getting grinded. So I got Teresa Blada to hopefully have be a reinvigorated, improved version of herself. And it's going to decision, but Blada will get her hand raised at the end of said decision.
And finally, they actually just dropped odds for this one while we were recording here. So it opened up crazy wide. So, you know, that's the cost of, you know, doing these shows for it, is that neither one of us is able to get the plus 525 opener
on Isaac?
Isaac Thompson versus Brito. Well, I would have taken that. I mean, he's still +305. At the time of this recording,
right, I'd take that too.
I'd take that too. Like, he's a pretty well-rounded guy. He cost me a whole bunch of money.
Oh, we would have hit a PRP on that LFA card, yep. Otherwise, man.
And that Russian was good. Or that, I don't know. Islam Boyev,
Azerbaijan or Uzbekistan.
He's from one of the satellite states. He's a very, very solid all-around fighter. It was damn close. Damn close. It was a UFC caliber fight. Brito's an absolute tank. Don't get me wrong. He could totally, muscle this kid around, but this kid's pretty solid in all facets of the game. And he showed in the Islam Boyev fight that, one, his takedown defense is on point. 2, his cardio is on point. So at +305, he would be the side for me.
Yeah, same thing. So this kid comes from the Gold Coast. He's one of these good-looking, hot Australian prospects, but he goes to Team Alpha Male, and I think that's made a world of difference for him. You're grinding in and out with good college wrestlers, and all of a sudden, it's like he's got a good ground game. He's got a really opportunistic submission game, good with his triangles, good with his arm bars, frame up an arm, take the limb home with you. just being in that room, constantly being pushed, his takedown defense has improved. His striking has always been pretty good. And now he's opening up more with his striking because he's got that confidence that he can stuff a takedown, keep this thing upright. He's only 23 years old, stands 5'11" at the weight class. It's like, there's a lot of really good stuff that you could like here. Now I'll admit I took Islamabov in his last fight because this guy's a dog on a bone, man. He just grind, takedown, 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 takedown. Very, very physically strong. And what you saw there is that Thompson showed up more than ready. Stuffed the vast majority of the takedowns. When he would get taken down, he gives up no real damage. Pops back up right away. Makes you work. And then he had a superior striking game to him. It was a split decision, but I knew in my heart that I should have edged out because I knew I lost. It was one of those, what are they looking at? Control time? Islamabov had the control time. Are they looking at damage? And nowadays they're looking at damage, and that's exactly what Thompson did. Mm-hmm. The thing with Joanderson Brito, as much as I love this guy, is he's one of these, I know I have a ton of power, and I rely entirely too much on said power. Guy's got to win over Diego Lopez on the Contender Series. No doubt about it, he's got legitimate skill. But time and time again, his fight with Bill Aljeo, he got out-muscled, he got out-worked. His fight with William Gomez, okay? Even though they gave him the split decision, Gomez has outlanded him 43-29. Jack Shore, before Jack Shore's shin got split open, he's working his way back into that fight. Jonathan Pierce is winning the fight before that ninja choke gets latched on. I'll give him a pass against Pat Sabatini. That guy does that to people. It is what it is. The point being is that Joanderson Brito is not really one of these guys that's going to go land 50, 60, 70 significant strikes. He's not. He averages less than 2.5 strikes landed per minute. He's had 10 fights in the UFC. And yet his average is less than 2.5 per minute. Okay, yeah. So then what does he do? Does he try to muscle guys to the ground? Well, as you can see against Pat Sabatini or against Jonathan Pierce, he's not a world-class grappler. I guess he choked out Pierce, but he can muscle you to the ground. And against a young kid here who's been training at a wrestling-heavy gym who just showed in his last fight that his takedown defense isn't bad, but two, his get-up game is good. Mm-hmm. That if your whole game plan is score a couple takedowns and try to muscle him out, it's not going to be enough. He's going to get back up. He's going to start to land some strikes. While it's short notice, this guy's getting ready to take on Melsik Bagdasarian. Okay, great. This is actually good for me. One, this kid's 23 years old. He's on a 4-fight winning streak, and he just won in the main event of an LFA card and looked good doing it. Mm-hmm. He knows his shot's right around the corner. You think he's sitting on the couch waiting for someone to call him? He's ready to go. The flip side to that for Brito, you go from taking on Melsik Bagdasarian can't grapple, okay, to a kid that very much can. Mm-hmm. This is a tougher fight for Joanderson Brito.
Agreed.
And I can get plus 300 on the Aussie. Yeah, all right, I'm in on that. And whoever caught the soft opener at plus 500, even better. Point being is that it's easy to say, oh, Joanderson Brito, yeah, that's right. He's a tenured vet, and he's had a full camp. And, you know, what's the biggest win of his career? Jonathan Pierce, he's cut. What about Jack Shore? He's cut too. What about Weston Wilson? Cut. Lucas Alexander, cut. Andre Feely, dope win. And Diego Lopez on the Contender Series, dope win. Those are 3-4 years ago. What has he done for you lately? He's lost his last two fights. Is what he's done for you lately. Don't fall into a trap where you're betting Joanderson Brito as a minus 300 favorite because you're just asking for it. Take it from a guy who just lost money betting against this kid. Don't fade him for no good reason, man. Know what you're getting yourself into.
Yeah. Yeah, and congratulations to the two people who got the plus 525, which was available for 1 minute. Literally 1 minute with 315. Or 314, 315. So literally it was there for a minute, went down to 350. And sorry, I moved it from plus 305 down to plus 295. So it's crashing. I've been hitting it. Ah, it's plus 280 now. Sorry, boys.
It's going to keep going. We'll wrap this show up right now.
Wrap it up and get your action in. Because we'll wrap up the show because that Thompson number is going to crash. I don't know what number. It's tough to really say, but probably like plus 150, like 60-40. Like, he's still coming in on short notice. He's, you know, only been fighting regional, but like, this fight could be more of like a pick'em type of thing. That's my initial thought on it. Anyway, we are just about out of time, Cody. But before we go, hit them with the PRP.
Yeah, what better time than to win a PRP on the last UFC event of the year? Brandon Royval, Kevin Velajos, Cesare Oleksichuk, Milk Costa. For some reason, I could flop on that one a little bit, but for the time being, we're going to roll with that Milk Costa one still. We're going to go with Marcus Buchecha, dog number one. We're going to go with Bobby Green. We're going to go with Jillian Robertson. Isaac Thompson, dog number two. Yaroslav Amosov. Don't feel great about that one either. Steve Asplund, Luana Santos, Guillerme Pat, Teresa Bleda. That is the PRP. And again, whatever, there's a bunch of regional stuff going on this weekend as well. UAE Warriors card starts tomorrow morning. So that's what I'm going to kind of shift my focus to right now. But yeah, used to think, oh man, you know, nothing like a UFC product. And then there's just random regionals. Now it's like these random regionals got fights on them that are just as good, if not better, than some of these low-grade UFC fight nights.
Not that UAE Warriors card. That UAE Warriors card is probably the worst UAE Warriors card I've seen.
Yeah,
well, it is a rough offering. I don't know if
fight pass is going away. It's like they're all probably just trying to get their last fight, their last card out, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know if we're going to get parlays for that one, but we'll see. Maybe they'll open them tonight. But yeah, when you got George Aid taking on Moha Jagdal in the main event, they're not exactly putting their best foot forward. There's usually a lot of good prospects on these UAE Warriors card, and it's like this one doesn't seem like their best offering.
Yeah, anyway. Well, the story I got, because there's a Unified this weekend too. It's on Friday, right? Mm-hmm. And Unified's deal with Fight Pass, it runs until the end of the year. Fight Pass stopped returning their calls. They were like, no more. So these guys are like, well, let's slap a card on together and we'll put it out. And it's going to be free on YouTube. Mm-hmm. They put it all together and then Fight Pass hits them up. They're like, we got a contract here that runs until the end of 2025. So apparently they're picking it up and it's going to be on Fight Pass. So honestly, who knows what the future holds? There's a lot of moving parts. But one thing that won't change is my man, me and Paul, sit here and we deliver you the best advice that we possibly can. And sometimes it goes right. Sometimes it doesn't go right. But it's all you can do is lick your wounds, dust yourself off, and try again. So this is a very middling, low-level fight night card. And sometimes those have been the most profitable for us. So fingers crossed, let's do the damn thing come Saturday.
And lastly, shouts to our boy, Jack Sear, fighting on the one card.
Hells yeah.
On Monday morning. Or sorry, on Friday morning. Hoping he can catch a neck, catch an arm, catch a limb, catch a W, and onwards and upwards from there. But everyone is pulling for our boy Jack Araba over in the Bookie Beatdown Discord this week. Anyway, that's it for us this week. Hope you enjoyed the show. For Cody, I'm Paul saying goodbye and good luck.